You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
To present his new book, The Caucasus, an introduction, published this month by Oxford University Press. The presentation takes place during the busiest international relations week of the year in New York City, when the UN General Assembly is underway. All of the heads of state, I imagine, or their foreign ministers of the countries discussed in Tom's wonderful new book are somewhere around Manhattan at this time. So that kind of gives an extra degree of relevance and sharpens our attention to the forthcoming presentation. I'm also very pleased to introduce Raj Menon, who probably doesn't need for this audience an introduction. He's the now the Spitzer Professor of Political Science at City College of New York, uptown. And he is going to moderate today's event and make some business announcements. So without further ado, Raj and Tom, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I'm Rajan Menon. As Anthony mentioned, I just started a new job at City College. I will begin this introduction of Tom DeWall with a cliche. And to paraphrase Henry Kissinger, the cliche is not only useful, it has the added advantage of being true. Tom doesn't need an introduction to a group like this. You're all here, presumably, because of your interest in that tragic and strife-torn part of the world, the Caucasus. And the reason he doesn't need an introduction is that his work is widely read. I had the pleasure of meeting Tom only just moments ago, but I feel like I know him vicariously because I think I've read certainly all his books and a good many other things he's written. And his work, I think, gets the attention that it does because it brings together three qualities that are rarely found in conjunction. One is meticulous scholarship with respect for the facts. The second is dogged investigative journalism, a skill that academics, I dare say, don't have. And the third is perhaps the most impressive, which is a willingness to bear witness and to report tragic events, sometimes amidst perilous violence and at the cost of great safety. These qualities are embodied in his major books, Chechnya, A Small Victorious War, which even today makes chilling reading and inspiring reading because Tom was, so to speak, present at the destruction. The second book, widely translated and widely read, is Black Garden, the story of Armenia and Azerbaijan, particularly focused on the Karabakh conflict. And third and most recently, his latest book, as Anthony mentioned, published by Oxford University Press this year, called Caucasus, an Introduction. For those of you who need an introduction, I can recommend no better book. To use another cliche, if you read only one book on the Caucasus this year, make this the book. Why? Because it has three qualities that I think are extraordinarily important. It is beautifully written. Prose is lucid. And I say this because for the past month, I've been plowing my way through political science journals, and reading the book yesterday, although I had to do it quickly, was quite a relief. The second is great moral clarity, because this is a part of the world, it's not the only part of the world where this is the case, where yesterday's heroes are apt to turn into today's villains. The clarity between good and bad is seldom clear, and I don't think Tom has any stake in being attached to certain personalities, and he sort of tells it like it is. And finally, the capacity to evoke settings and paint people in a very colorful way. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tom, who will speak, I understand, for between 40 and 45 minutes. There will be a Q&A, which I'll moderate. Don't forget to speak into the microphone. And I have been asked to start off the Q&A with two questions of my own, and we invite you to participate. So please, well, join me in welcoming Tom DeWall.
Well, thanks so much, Anthony and Raj. After that introduction, how do I do my own introduction? Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be here in New York. Thanks for fitting me in during UN General Assembly week. It's good to see some familiar faces around the table. And also the dedicatee of the book, my daughter Zoe, who's the youngest member of the audience, is also over there with my wife Georgina, who, without whom, and it certainly is true, it is a cliche, but it is true, the book would not have been possible. So what I'd like to do is give you, it'll probably be a little less than Raj promised, which is probably a relief, and maybe around half an hour, a kind of presentation, which is my attempt to do a kind of synopsis of the book. And it's really looking at the South Caucasus as a region. I make no apology for regarding it as a region, something that I will discuss, trying to take a regional approach to the South Caucasus. The book comes with a slight health warning. Although it's called The Caucasus in Introduction, it's actually not about the North Caucasus. I had some discussions about this with my publisher. I said, well, maybe we should call it The South Caucasus, an introduction. They said, well, we won't sell as many books. If you want to read about the North Caucasus, don't buy the book. But if you want to read about the South Caucasus, it is over there at the back, and I'll be happy to sign it. But I want to address the question about why are things so bad? Why is this region still in such a mess? And what role did we people in the Western world, in Europe, in the United States, what role have we played in keeping it a mess, in not solving its problems? And I think those are primarily problems of perception, and that's really what I want to talk about. When I talk about three mirages, I'm talking about three misconceptions of this region. And I've got a few pictures to accompany my presentation. So here we are, 20 years after the end of the Soviet Union, and the South Caucasus, by which I mean the countries of Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, and associated territories, present us with a very sad picture. The map still torn up by war, two longest borders in the region, partially or fully closed, the borders between Georgia and Russia, Armenia and Azerbaijan, still massive poverty and unemployment. If we took a look at the world GDP table, oil-rich Azerbaijan has climbed up a bit in the last few years, but still is only barely half as rich as Russia or Turkey. Armenia and Georgia even further behind. If you compare them, these countries, Armenia and Georgia, to their former Soviet co-republic Estonia, Estonia is six times richer than Armenia or Georgia, an astonishing statistic in the last 20 years. So an enormous human potential, I would say, is being disgracefully squandered here. Now, clearly, locals bear the prime responsibility for this sad picture, but I think outsiders do as well. And I think the outsiders have had failures of perception. So what I want to outline in this presentation is what I call three mirages, three misguided approaches to the region that obscure proper understanding of the way it works. And also I'll talk about, at the end, two markets, which I think constitute a positive counter example. Now, I talk about the South Caucasus as a region, and I make no apology for doing that. But let me explain why I do, because some people say the South Caucasus is a colonial construction. It used to be the Trans-Caucasus. It was basically a Russian colonial construction. Nowadays, we can do away with that concept, talk about a wider Black Sea region, or maybe just engage with the countries one by one. I don't share that view. And I think there are a number of reasons why it does make sense to talk about this as a region. Now, look at the map, and the map is behind me, and you see, you take a basic geographical fact. The highest mountains in Europe to the north, stretching in that diagonal down from the Black to the Caspian Seas. The Greek geographer Strabo had the famous phrase, they form a rampart, so the isthmus, which separates one sea from another. There are also, I believe, cultural similarities between the peoples of the South Caucasus, which in terms of culture, family practices, music, which are more than just folkloric. I think they help give a sort of commonality of culture, which I think dispels the myth of ancient hatreds between these people. If you take these people out of a difficult political context, they get along very well. Look at Armenians and Azeris on the territory of Georgia, in Iran, in Moscow. They find much more in common than they do with Russians or with Iranians. Obviously, the Russian history also, the last 200 years, has also helped form these people. It's made this a much more secular region, a more Europeanized region than either Iran to the south or Turkey to the southwest. And finally, it's an economic region. And I date the economic region back to the year 1890 and to the building of this tunnel. This is the Surami Railroad Tunnel, which was built through the highlands of central Georgia. Now, if I just go back a moment.
These highlands cutting down here,
right, eastern and western Georgia, and western Georgia was always much more the Ottoman part and eastern Georgia the Persian part, and that persisted, those cultural differences persisted right into the end of the 19th century. Finally, in 1890, the Russians built a railroad tunnel. They connected the two parts of Georgia together, and suddenly the South Caucasus was a transport and communications hub, and also the world's first oil pipeline followed the same route under those mountains. It was called the Kerosene Pipeline, and it was a forerunner to all the modern pipelines that we see. Now, this shared economic space gives the South Caucasus potential, linking Russia in the north, Iran in the south, the Black and Caspian Seas. This really is the great potential of this region as the lands in between, but unfortunately, it's also a very vulnerable economic space. We saw that we've seen that in the last century in 1905, 1918, 1992, and in 2008. A disruption in one place can cause shutdowns in another. A disruption of the Surami Tunnel in 1905 by Marxist revolutionaries suddenly severed Georgia in half. And similar things happened in 2008 during the Georgian War. Now, we've been here before. This is a recurring problem. And let me quote the report of one foreign observer to you. The three governments, from an Occidental standpoint, are now thoroughly inefficient, without credit, and undoubtedly corrupt. Alone, each faces inextricable financial difficulties. Religious differences, added to racial, threaten to embroil them unless brought under a common control. Two of them have no outlet to the Black Sea, except through Georgia over the railroad. They have at present no monetary, postal or customs union, and as stated, no definite agreement for common control and use of the railroad, are in continual squabbles over boundaries. Azerbaijan has no educated class capable of well administering a government. Georgia is threatened by Bolshevism. Armenia is in ruins and partial starvation. The report was written in 1919. The observer was the US General James Harbord, who was sent to the region by President Woodrow Wilson to look at the feasibility of adopting the South Caucasus under a US mandate. Well, obviously, maybe a nice idea, but one which was rather unrealizable. So what I'm saying is that this regional breakdown has happened before, and I see that the South Caucasus swinging between the pendulum swinging between, on the one hand, a condition of regional security with no liberty, as it had under the Tsarist Empire of the Soviet Union, or liberty but no regional security, which is what it had in that period of 1918 to 21, and again from the 1990s. So I think the challenge this region faces is how to combine the twin goals of both regional security and liberty. And again, parallels between those two periods in which neighbours fight each other, the great powers get involved. Though there's James Harbord, I should have shown you him earlier, sent to the region, as I said, in 1919, but only lasted a year because the Bolsheviks came back. This is 1915, Armenians being deported from eastern Anatolia to their deaths, mainly at the hands of Turks and Kurds at the crash of the Ottoman Empire. And this is 1993, the crash of the Soviet Empire, Azerbaijanis fleeing Kelbajar during the Nagorno-Karabakh War. It's a messy situation, it's a recurring situation, and I think what Harbord was describing was how the local actors are really the ones who set the rules of the game. So my first mirage that I want to lay out before you is the illusion that this is a great chessboard where the big powers set the goals and then push the locals around like pawns. That's not actually what happens here. In actual fact, the locals manipulate the outside powers just as much as the other way around. The cost is high, but the locals always survive. Compare the South Caucasus in the 21st century to northern Iran or eastern Anatolia. The three independent countries there, whereas the minorities of Iran and of Turkey have basically been either driven out or assimilated. So in this region, the price of survival has come in the form, however, of Faustian alliances with other great powers. What General Harbord was observing was a regional rivalry in which, to protect themselves, Azerbaijanis allied themselves with Turks and British, Georgians with Germans and British, Armenians, Abkhaz and Ossetians with Russians. By doing so, these small powers inevitably ended up at war with one another and as proxies in great power conflicts. In 1920-21, the Bolshevik takeover didn't so much resolve the contradictions as smother them. If we fast forward to the 1980s, as Soviet power faded in the late Gorbachev period, the pendulum swung again. In a close replica of the earlier period, Abkhaz and Ossetians sought Russian assistance against what they saw to be a Georgian nationalist threat, and then newly independent Georgia looked to new Western allies to protect itself against a perceived Russian threat. In Soviet times, a conflict between Georgians and Ossetians would have been unthinkable. The two ethnic groups had the highest level of marriage in Soviet Georgia. They traded with one another and still do, if they're given the opportunity. But the unhealthy dynamics of the post-Soviet era drove each to seek the protection of different patrons in Washington and Moscow. Eventually, in 2008, this local conflict in South Ossetia turned into the arena of the worst clash between Russia and the United States since the end of the Cold War. And as you all know, this is what happened. This is Tskhinvali in August 2008 after the Georgian artillery bombardment. And this is Gori burning under Russian bombing during the same conflict. So to my mind, it's better not to describe this picture as a giant chessboard, but as a castle of dominoes where the whole construction totters if you dislodge one piece. If you try and treat the region as a game of chess, everyone loses. This brings me to Russia and what I regard as another mirage, that of the Russian bear looming over this region, ready to maul the small Caucasian peoples. This view is persistent, not least because many Russians still share it, but I believe it's highly exaggerated. Now let me be clear about this. Russia is still the most powerful outside actor in the region, if only by default. Russia currently has troops in Akhalgori, 30 miles from Tbilisi. I'm not saying that Russia is a small actor, I'm just saying it's one actor amongst many, and its role is somewhat exaggerated. My point really is that Russia's capacity to control events is always smaller than it seems. The peoples of the South Caucasus have actually spent two centuries, I would argue, cultivating the skill of playing off Russia and quietly getting on with their own agenda. Now again, I think geography plays a determining role here. Contrast the South and the North Caucasus. In the North Caucasus, Russia also generally tries to rule by consent, but it can, if it wants to, resort to the overwhelming use of military power. South of the mountains, Russia's capacities are stretched even further. Now this is the Georgian military highway. The physical barrier, again, of the Caucasus Mountains limits Russia's capacity. This road was built, the only road across the whole of the main Caucasus range was built only in 1817, and it's still basically the basic main crossing between Russia and Georgia, very difficult to get over, and very difficult to get artillery over. And this is primarily one reason why Russia could not use overwhelming military power in the South Caucasus. It's also reflected, Russian presence is also reflected in small population numbers. The number of ethnic Russians was always small, and it's now less than 2% of the total of the South Caucasus. Compare that to, say, Kazakhstan or the Baltic states, and you see that Russia has always had to rely on local elites to govern the Caucasus, that its levers of control are perhaps smaller than looks at first glance. In the 20th century, this was particularly true. Of course, ultimate authority lay in Soviet times lay in Moscow, and Moscow ordered mass repression here as it did in the rest of the Soviet Union. But locals ran the show pretty much from the beginning. And here are some locals that I have in mind. There's a man called Joseph Djougashvili in the middle, better known as Stalin. On the left, Anastas Mikoyan, Sergei Orjonikidze on the right. The Bolsheviks who ran the show from the 1920s were pretty much the local Bolsheviks. Obviously, they're local Bolsheviks who believed in Russia, but they also had very much a local agenda, and I think this is, again, important to understand. This was a local project which was very much a co-Russian and Caucasian project. Now, we fast forward a generation, and here is another man, Heydar Aliyev, welcoming Brezhnev to Baku in 1970. Now, if you look at that picture and you didn't know who was who, you might question who was the one really in charge. And I think this tells you again how skilled Aliyev was at manipulating Brezhnev, how he basically ran his own show in Azerbaijan. And here's another example, Shevardnadze, again another member of the Politburo, very close to Gorbachev, also ran Georgia for a decade and a half and was the most important figure there. Let me remind you that these two gentlemen, Aliyev and Shevardnadze, were members of the Politburo, loyal servants of Moscow, but in the 1990s they very smoothly made the transition to being the presidents of Azerbaijan, independent Azerbaijan and Georgia, and no one saw a great contradiction in this. So that in a sense, in the Soviet era, they had actually been the local feudal lords of their republics as well. So Russia and the South Caucasus. 2008, we saw, of course, Russia intervening militarily in Georgia. Many saw this as an example of Russian neo-imperialism. I have a slightly different interpretation. I see this more as Russia making an intervention in two regions, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, in which it believed it had a very strong stake. Even, I would say, recent events such as a consolidation of a military alliance with Armenia cannot disguise a long-term strategic retreat from the Caucasus, something that we can perhaps talk about later. So why the misunderstanding? Well, in part because Russia has many actors, in part because Russia is still powerful, of course, but largely, as I've just alluded to, because Abkhazia and South Ossetia, I think, are special cases. Both of these provinces border the Russian North Caucasus, in a sense, half in the North Caucasus, half in the South Caucasus. Both have traditionally looked to Russia as a counterweight against Georgian assimilation. And besides, ordinary Russians also have very strong connections to Abkhazia, just as they do to Crimea. And here's why. This is the beach at Pitsunda. Basically, I think Abkhazia and Crimea were the two prime southern holiday spots for Russians in the Soviet era. In fact, in the book I have a little passage called Soviet Florida, which is all about basically about Abkhazia and perceptions, Russian perceptions of the Caucasus as a holiday zone. So both Abkhazia and South Ossetia basically accepted a de facto Russian control as a price for secession de facto secession from Georgia in 92 and 93. But even here, I believe Russia is actually more vulnerable than it looks. Russia, I think, has stored up problems for itself by its unilateral recognition of the independence of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. It's certainly stored up a lot of problems in the North Caucasus. No big countries, if you except three rather outlying countries, have followed Russia's suit in recognizing those two republics as independent. So I do believe that Russia is a difficult and prickly beast, but one that Western powers can actually do business with in the Caucasus, that we are now facing a post-imperial Russia in the Caucasus rather than neo-imperial Russia in the region. And I do believe that the North Caucasus is a prime reason why eventually Russia will need to be flexible over Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Russia's need to stabilize the North Caucasus is a reason why Russia will have to want to do a deal eventually over Abkhazia and South Ossetia. My third mirage is what I call the mirage of strategic significance. In the last 20 years, Western Europe and the United States have rediscovered the South Caucasus, sometimes with great enthusiasm. Now, this enthusiasm has its upside and it has its downside. And I believe the downside is rather exaggerating this as an area of great strategic significance. And such talk, I believe, can do more harm than good. Two big projects have treated the South Caucasus in these terms, as a bridgehead to be seized, as a place for big top-down Western intervention. One of them was to treat the region as an absolutely essential new energy corridor for Caspian Sea oil and gas, and the other one was a zone for NATO enlargement. Now, again, I want to be understood properly here. In energy terms, the South Caucasus is indeed an important transport corridor. The Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline is a very important project which has brought billions of dollars of much needed revenue to Azerbaijan. The gas pipeline in particular has brought weaned Georgia from total dependence on Russian gas. My concerns are that these useful energy projects were overly politicized and that were not made part maybe of a more integrated economic vision. Let me explain a bit why. Resource extraction tends to benefit elites and foreign companies more than it does ordinary people. Certainly it creates very few jobs, and less than 2% of the Azerbaijani workforce is employed in the oil and gas industry. Without a broader economic strategy, energy wealth has the capacity to aggravate social divisions rather than ease them. This is current Baku, with its skyscrapers, beginning to look more and more like Dubai every year. But if you go outside of Baku, you find a very poor country in Azerbaijan, and there are real questions about what happens to that country in 10, 15 years when the oil reserves begin to run out. And secondly, I think too many Western policymakers treated pipeline policy as a big strategic game of you win, I lose. There were exaggerated claims made in the 1990s that the Caspian Sea was going to be the new Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. These claims turned out to be very exaggerated. And a pair of unhelpful metaphors made things worse by winding back history. The image of a new Silk Road stretching from Central Asia across to the Black Sea is one. But it conjures up, I think, rather unhelpfully, a medieval era of pre-modern principalities and before Russia was involved in the region, casting the locals as some kind of medieval pre-modern actors. The idea of a great game, I think, was even more harmful. Comparing the new interest in the South Caucasus with the struggle for influence between Tsarist Russia and Great Britain in the 19th century in Central Asia, again casting the locals as passive objects, not subjects, and Moscow in the role of deadly rival. This is a cartoon from Punch magazine from the 19th century. He looks like a Caucasian. He's actually an Afghan emir, and the caption underneath actually reads, "Save me from my friends." which I believe is possibly how some Caucasians feel when they're being cast as the objects of a deadly rivalry between Russia and the West. And some of them may ask, well, why can't we actually have both? So in retrospect, I think grand strategic ambitions for the region ran ahead of a more sober assessment of its place on the map. The second grand strategic vision imposed on the Caucasus was that of NATO expansion into Georgia. Again, I want to be properly understood here. The issue is not Georgia's right to join NATO, and the Georgian public did vote for this by a good majority in a referendum. The issue was whether active pursuit of this was a good policy for either Georgia or NATO, and I believe it was not. The plan did not improve Georgia's security. In 2008, the Russian leadership said the move was a direct threat, and the Abkhaz and the South Ossetians turned even closer to Russia to be their protector. In mid-August 2008, when the conflict with Russia had played itself out, and I believe the NATO issue was one of the prime triggers of that conflict, Georgia was left with neither Abkhazia and South Ossetia nor a membership action plan for NATO. So far better, in my view, than this kind of rhetorical and selective strategic engagement would have been far more focused, lower-level investment in institution building from below. That would at least allow the locals to make sober assessments of their own capacities and what they themselves should ask from Western patrons with limited attention spans. This leads me to the paradoxical conclusion that a healthy dose of strategic insignificance would be positive for the South Caucasus and would allow all interested parties to concentrate on helping solve its everyday problems. So again, I get back to the idea of a region. The many problems of the South Caucasus are linked and cannot, I believe, be solved in isolation. A rethink of policy towards the region should therefore begin with Dwight Eisenhower's recommendation: if you can't solve a problem, enlarge it. To calm its security problems, the South Caucasus would be well served by some kind of truce between the latter-day great powers, in which they accept the interests of the others so long as their intentions are not hostile. That covers Turkey. Sooner or later includes Iran, which has an ancient historic interest in the region. Chiefly, it concerns Russia and the West. The outsiders should agree not to provide offensive weapons to the region and to work together to halt any slide to conflict. That vision only makes sense if the region belongs to no security organization, its in-between status making it a zone of neutrality rather than conflict. At the moment, that vision is clearly utopian, given the heavy Russian presence in Abkhazia and South Ossetia and the smoldering volcano of the Karabakh dispute. Still, outsiders have greater freedom to imagine a different future, however distant, than locals do, and can frame their policies with that destination in mind. Hand in hand with the vision for greater security goes an economic vision, which only makes sense as a regional project, with the South Caucasus imagined as a free trade zone and communications hub, radiating out to five points of a star to Russia, the Caspian Sea, Iran, Turkey, and the Black Sea. The day I believe the railway line is reopened through Russia, Abkhazia, Georgia, Armenia, Nakhichevan to Iran is the day the South Caucasus regains its role as a region with real prospects for the future. Now, this is the picture at the moment. This is the railway line in Abkhazia, a railway line going nowhere, and a similar picture down in Nakhichevan, which used to be the main stop on the Moscow-Tehran railway, and now is literally a kind of tiny bubble of rusting trains. But Nakhichevan could be Georgia's route to Iran, and Abkhazia could be Russia's route to Armenia. So few locals and outsiders currently think in these regional terms. And here I get back to the problem of Western perceptions. Narrow bilateralism is an abiding problem in Caucasus policy and is made worse by the multiple policy agendas of a country such as Russia or the United States. With some honourable exceptions, I'm afraid that in Washington nowadays there's less often a South Caucasus policy than three bilateral policies, each with its own adherents. There's an Armenia policy, mainly situated in Congress, an Azerbaijan policy, situated around the oil and gas companies and the Pentagon, and a Georgia policy, which still holds out Georgia as some kind of post-Soviet model of democratization. But unfortunately, never the three shall meet. Bilateralism helps reinforce divisions. many members of Caucasian governing elites are opposed to regional cooperation, which reduces their own power and cuts the profits of cartels run by their friends and allies. They also prefer to keep the population as economic clients, not independent actors. Even the most reformist economic government in the region, that of Mikhail Saakashvili in Georgia, rules from the centre by fiat, moving from one favoured project to the next. Saakashvili is said to have chosen himself the colour of the new buildings in his mass redevelopment of the port city, Batumi. Actually, he apparently was live on air and announced proudly to viewers that this new building being thrown up in Batumi was going to be green. And this was the president choosing the colour of that new building. The most promising agents of change in the Caucasus are, to my mind, some of the most marginal players at the moment, small businessmen and traders. There is huge entrepreneurial energy here, but sadly too much of it is being used outside the region by migrants who should be working inside their countries. One day these people could follow the trail blazed by the businessmen of Turkish Anatolia, who have spearheaded Turkey's dynamic growth over the past decade. Currently these people are outside their countries, not inside them. Small traders and their respecters of borders or ethnic difference, and the mythical ancient hatreds that politicians sometimes conjure up to mobilise loyalty and hatred. International organisations have spent millions over the past two decades on peace-building projects in the South Caucasus. But to my mind, the two most effective catalysts for cross-border cooperation were two markets that were entirely spontaneous. One was outside the village of Egneti, on the administrative border between South Ossetia and Georgia's Gori region. It was so large that buyers would drive up and down it on motorcycles. Georgians and Ossetians traded almost everything there, from cars to matches, and the profits of the market sustained South Ossetia for a decade. The second market was in the village of Sadakhlo, inside Georgia. And yet there were almost no Georgians to be found there, as thousands of Armenians and Azerbaijanis bought and sold all kinds of household goods and agricultural produce. And these are some Azeri women selling tangerines primarily to Armenians. Again, it was an astonishing sight to go just a few kilometres into Georgia and to see a market where the only people really were Armenians and Azeris, supposedly two nations at war. Georgian and Armenian politicians closed both of these markets down in the earlier part of the last decade, saying that they were a massive source of tax-free trade. Technically speaking, both these markets were indeed havens of smuggling. But to my mind, it would have been far better to keep them open and work to legalise their operations and channel them in a more legal direction. As it happened, the closure of Egneti in 2004 reoriented the South Ossetian economy away from Georgia towards Russia, setting the territory on a path of conflict. The closure of Sadakhlo shut down a place which had vaccinated thousands of Armenians and Azeris against hateful stereotypes. Despite its exterior of nationalist unanimity, the lesson of the two markets is that under the surface, the South Caucasus is still a place of dynamic individuals. So, if the great game strategists want to make a positive difference here, my recommendation to them is that they consider retraining as small business consultants. As for Western policymakers, I believe they should ask themselves two questions every time they decide to make an intervention in the South Caucasus. The first is my action helping to open borders and free up a blocked region? And the second, does it empower ordinary people and not just governments? There is enough local talent here, it is just a matter of mobilising it to break down barriers and close borders and not to entrench them. Thank you.
Please have questions ready. Let me just, pardon me, get the ball rolling, Tom, by asking you two questions that will cover all of the South Caucasus. You're understandably reluctant to speculate on how some of these conflicts might be solved, but let me push you a little bit and ask you to do just that, namely speculate. So in the case of the Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict, one can envisage the following hypothetical solutions, probably more, but this is all I've got. One is a deal under which a land corridor connecting Nakhichevan and the rest of Azerbaijan is created, front-loaded to get buy-in from the Azerbaijani public and the government with the understanding that there would then be a referendum in Karabakh, the results of which the Azerbaijanis would accept. Down the road, there would be a negotiation on territories unspecified at the beginning that the Armenians would evacuate. Now, this raises all kinds of difficulties about some of the districts, in particular Kelbajar and Lachin, for reasons that you know all too well. The second possibility is a evacuation by Armenia of everything, which is, of course, difficult to do. But on the flip side, for Azerbaijan to accept in return for the authentically Azerbaijani districts, to accept the right to self-determination of the Karabakh Armenians by referendum. And then the third would be the same thing with the Azerbaijanis evacuating everything except Lachin, which gives them egress to Karabakh and gives the Karabakh Armenians some insurance policy. So that's one question, and I ask this because when you go on the ground, depending on who you talk to, you get the following impression. Well, time is running against Armenia. Notwithstanding the result, the alignment with Russia, Russia is a fickle ally. The GDP of Azerbaijan, if I remember the statistics in your book correctly, $1.3 billion in 1994. That's a little bit of a bad baseline because the economy had collapsed in 1994. But nevertheless, it's about $25 billion now. With that comes the capacity for international contacts, weapons, and what have you. And the question is, will the Azerbaijanis decide that if they can't solve this diplomatically, they will perforce solve this militarily? So a settlement of some sort seems to be, if not urgent, then certainly something important. The second question has to do with the status of the two statelets, which to my mind are lost to Georgia, whether the Georgians like it or not, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Now, at the moment, the Russians are the protectors of these two, but as you well know, the Abkhaz and the Russians have a much more checkered history in the 19th century, where the Abkhaz were troublesome, revolting subjects of the Russian Tsar. What are the implications for Russia's North Caucasus, which is now aflame and in some sense more complicated than it was when the problem was restricted largely to Chechnya, of having created these two entities that are under Russian supervision, dependent on Russia now, but that have close historic, ethnic, cultural ties to their kinsmen and women on the other side of the border? Have they, the Russians, bought themselves in the long run trouble that may yet not be foreseen by them? So, thank you.
Right, so first question is, how do we solve the three conflicts? I'm glad you posed an easy one to me, Rod. Thank you. I think, well, the first point to make is that although there will be elements of kind of compromise over sovereignty in all the solutions, I think each of them has to be taken differently. But let me slightly sort of work round your question by saying that I think if there is sufficient will on both sides, I think, you know, these particular circles can be squared. With the case of the Karabakh conflict, I think there's a very sophisticated document on the table, which envisages withdrawal from Armenians from the territories around they currently occupy around Karabakh, which no one disputes are part of Azerbaijan, some kind of interim international status for Karabakh, and the prospect of some kind of popular vote in the future on the status of Karabakh. Basically kind of trying to get around this perpetual status of the status of Karabakh with this idea of interim status. Why is this not working? Not because this is not a good plan. I think it's a very good plan. It's more about what I see as a perpetual vicious cycle in this peace process, which is that the locals look at the internationals and say, you don't really care enough about this conflict. Why should we sign on the dotted line? We'll just stick with the status quo. You're not really going to offering us many resources to fix this conflict. And then the internationals look at the locals and say, well, you're not being very constructive. You don't really have the will to resolve this conflict. So why should we invest any resources in it? And both sides kind of manage the conflict. Meanwhile, the long-term trend starts to get worse, as you've alluded to. Azerbaijan is currently rearming, spending $2 billion a year on weapons. And yet no one actually believes there is a military scenario which would work for Azerbaijan of reconquest in this conflict. And in England, I'm sure you probably have the same in the States, we have the expression, possession is nine-tenths of the law, which is what the Armenians rely on, that they actually control the land, that they have they've rewritten the facts on the ground. And so Azerbaijan really has to kind of destroy all the facts on the ground in order to rewrite the narrative in its favor, which is obviously not a very promising scenario. So we somehow got to break out of this circle whereby the two sides completely distrust each other and posit nothing constructive to get their relationship moving forward. And the internationals see, well, look at this conflict and say it's too intractable, we can just manage it rather than invest heavy resources into resolving it. I really don't see how that's going to happen. I fear that the only way it's going to happen is that things will get worse before they get better, which is not a scenario I particularly want to see, that there'll be some major bad incident which will wake up the world towards the need to resolving this conflict. When we get to Abkhazia and South Ossetia, I do believe that, again, we have to look at the long term. I believe at the moment it's very personal between the Russian leadership and the Georgian leadership. Putin and Medvedev on one hand and Saakashvili on the other. They really loathe each other, and the things they say about each other are pretty much unprintable. And so there's no way they can have a relationship. So we have to be, at the moment, we really have to be managing that situation until President Saakashvili serves out his second term, which will be January 2013. The Georgians are actually busy rewriting the constitution and may end up with a parliamentary system by then, which would pose the issue about whether Saakashvili is positioning himself to be prime minister. But even so, there will be a formal handover at that point in 2013, at which point I think there are a few pointers to how Georgia and Russia can start to be a bit more flexible towards one another. The Sochi Olympics 2014, I think Russia really generally wants Abkhazia to be part of those Olympics, wants foreign guests to go there, and that implies some kind of concessions which on the sovereignty of Abkhazia, which means that foreigners would be willing to go there. If you look at South Ossetia, I mentioned earlier that Georgians and Ossetians, you know, used to have this market in Egneti. South Ossetia was 100% part of the Georgian economy until very recently. And now, apparently, since the war, prices have shot up because these Ossetians, they can no longer buy their tomatoes in Gori. They have to get it imported through the Rocky Tunnel from Russia. This is absolutely crazy. And so, again, if the border can be opened to trade, then I think Ossetians will start to rebuild the economic links with Georgia. And both my colleague Dmitry Trendin and I have separately advocated the idea of South Ossetia as the Andorra of the Caucasus. For those of you who are not so familiar with Andorran politics, Andorra, since the 13th century, has had two heads of state, one in France and one in Spain, and still does. It's actually now a member of the UN, but still the President of France and the Bishop of Catalonia, its twin heads of state. So Andorrans basically don't have to choose. And I think if Ossetians and inhabitants of South Ossetia didn't have to choose between Georgia and Russia, they would be perfectly happy, as long as if they could have both. I think that would be fine. So this implies some kind of mental shift, certainly on the part of Georgia. But I think if we take it slowly, it is possible. Abkhazia is more difficult. But again, I do see long-term reasons why Abkhazia will want to break out of its current status and reach out to the world, which would mean some kind of accommodation with Georgia, which keeps their relationship with Russia at the same time.
Ah, yes, you told me this. I'm sorry, Anthony. Yeah, just before we turn it over, just an observation, Tom. I don't think that war between Armenia and Azerbaijan is imminent by any means. But the fact that it's difficult to create facts on the ground is a sort of thin reed on which to base one's hopes, because if you look at the region, facts have been created on the ground. And it could have been argued before they were created that, in fact, no one would possibly want to create them. But the facts on the ground were created by virtue of Armenian military power. And the question is whether or not we think those facts can be reversed. The question is what the Azerbaijanis will think in a position of superior strength down the road if diplomatic options have run out. So, again, it's not a doomsday scenario, but in this region, facts are created and uncreated with some regularity. Can we? What is the custom, Anthony? Do you ask people to identify themselves? What shall I?
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Right. So, if you'd ask your question and tell us who you are, please, I will play traffic cop.
My name is Dr. Polner. I'm president of Cinema Verite International, Inc., and I've made documentaries in this part of the world. I've lectured before the Harriman Institute, and that's part of my question, which is the Institute, as well as other institutions, have recently put out a document called Rethinking Russia. And it appears that Obama seems to have a tremendous amount of activity which he's engaged in the United States. He does not, as far as I can see, he does not seem to see this part of the world as one of his major entities. So in that light, and since Russia itself is having major problems with drought and so on, my question to you is, if you had to rethink Russia's strategy at this point in this part of the world, what do you speculate they might be thinking of considering? Thank you very much.
Well, I alluded to this idea that Russia is sort of now a post-imperial power. This is also a phrase of my colleague Dmitry Trenin, which I think is a useful one, by which, and I think, what does he mean by that? I think he means that Russia is concentrated on consolidating its own statehood rather than rebuilding an empire. That it does not want, it sees these its neighborhood as it wants a kind of a zone of stability, which is why it was so opposed to NATO enlargement, which it saw as a threat to its security, whether true or false, that was definitely Russia's perception. It wants relatively stable neighbors. It wants, I think, to be economic actors in those neighbours, and certainly if you look at the Caucasus, Russia owns most of the assets of Armenia, is doing business, a lot of business with Azerbaijan over gas recently, and still had a lot of business in Georgia, interestingly enough, despite the supposedly in the state of virtual war. Increasingly wants to be an economic power. And yes, it wants to use have its military outposts there, but I see those as being more military outposts rather than actual sort of military domination. And again, look at the refusal to intervene in Kyrgyzstan. Russia saying actually we do not want to sacrifice our young men in Kyrgyzstan. Sure, this is a place that we value, that is important to us, but we're not going to be the policemen here. So I see that Russia, and obviously there are different Russias, just as there are different United States, with certainly wanting to keep a lot of influence in this region, but not in the kind of rather domineering military fashion that it did in the 90s. And I do think that opens up the possibility of the sort of more peaceful collaboration that happens with Russia in other parts of the world as well.
Thanks, Tom, for the presentation. You said, continuing on this idea about Russia being maybe not so powerful as we think. You said something that Russia, because of the North Caucasus, will have to do a deal and will have to compromise. I was wondering, with whom do you envisage the deal, the self-empowered locals, as you postulate, or are there other outside powers? Because we haven't talked much about Turkey, about Iran, about the United States. And so what is this deal? I actually don't entirely buy the proposition that Russia's so not so powerful here. When I think about the post-Soviet space, the Baltic, European parts like Ukraine and Belarus and Central Asia, it seems of all of the former constituent parts of the Soviet Union, in fact, that the Russian position is strongest in the South Caucasus. So I'm interested in why you think they have to make a deal and what that deal is.
Mm. Well, first of all, I sort of would push back on that, because I don't believe that Russia, if you look at Central Asia, I believe, you know, its geographical isolation, the large Russian population, there are many reasons why Russia, I think, has a strong hand to play there. The South Caucasus is much more open and always has been to the world and its other neighbours. Ukraine obviously is a bit of a different kettle of fish, but again, a large Russian population and Crimea, many reasons why Russia has its cards, its levers it can pull in those places. I just don't see those in the South Caucasus, with the exception of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which are, as I say, kind of half in, half out of the South Caucasus. And again, even in the 1990s, when Russia was these states are incredibly weak, and Russia, you know, conspired to help bring Shevardnadze back to Georgia and Aliyev back to Azerbaijan. What did they do? They actually ended up consolidating Azerbaijani and Georgian statehood against Russia in the long term. So there's also the law of unintended consequences here. When we look why would Russia want to be more flexible, do a deal? Well, look at South Ossetia, population there of about 30,000 people. This recognizing South Ossetia as independent, when you have on the other side of the mountains North Ossetia, which has about 600,000 people, Ingushetia, very unhappy with the Ossetians, Chechnya, a million people, it sets a bad precedent, and definitely questions are being asked there. At the moment, those questions are being suppressed, but certainly it sets a bad precedent about why one small Caucasian territory can be independent and others can't. So I think there's definitely the lid on Pandora's box was opened by those recognitions in the North Caucasus. We've still got a lot of violence in the North Caucasus, and Georgia inevitably will be, if the violence spikes again, people will flee into Georgia, particularly in the summer months. So there's a reason that you wanted to collaborate with the Georgians. The Sochi Olympics, I've already mentioned. I think there is a point in which, they will want to ask for Western help, maybe intelligence help in this region. And the Turks, again, have a lot of influence because of the Circassian diaspora. So there are all sorts of outside actors. I'm not talking about next year or next month. I'm talking about in a longer perspective, who could help Russia in the North Caucasus. And I think the quid pro quo for that is that Abkhazia and South Ossetia are opened up. They're not necessarily handed back to Georgia on a plate, but they're opened up and Russia is more flexible over them. So the question is, Saakashvili will no longer be in office at a certain point. Well, it's quite possible, as I said, that the constitution of Georgia is being changed. In 2013, he will, as it were, do a Putin, stop being president and become prime minister. That is quite plausible. And of course, this raises a lot of questions about Georgia is Georgia just becoming a kind of one-party system? But having said that, that scenario may not come to pass. If you adopt a parliamentary system, you are, I think voters tend to vote less for personalities and more for parties in the parliamentary system, and at some point a coalition could be formed to of two successful parties to keep out this, to try and keep out this ruling party from office. That's one scenario. And even if Saakashvili does become a kind of powerful prime minister, there will be a president, and if Russia could say, okay, we'll deal with the president, who is the head of state, rather than the prime minister, rather than, as the Armenians, for example, deal with President Gül in Armenia, but not Prime Minister Erdogan, who they prefer to deal with Gül rather than Erdogan. So, you know, there are precedents there as well.
Does North Ossetia have any bearing on
North Ossetia has a huge bearing on the fate of South Ossetia. And North Ossetia basically runs South Ossetia. North Ossetia, in collaboration with the FSB, the security services. But what's actually happening in the moment, and if you haven't read it, I do urge you to read the International Crisis Group's latest report on South Ossetia. Is South Ossetia is emptying, as most of the people who don't like the current president, Kokoity, just cross the border and take up residence in Vladikavkaz. So at some point, I think Kokoity may be moved on. The Russians, I think, are rather unhappy with him. And North Ossetia will start to run South Ossetia again. But certainly it is the big cousin over the border. South Ossetia is a very small agricultural place, and North Ossetia, it really is the Ossetian heartland.
Is there a chance
just speak into the microphone?
Is there a chance that they will unify at some point?
I don't see them unifying. I'm sure that lots of Ossetians would like to unify them, but there are huge mountains in between and one tunnel, and I think, as I said, South Ossetia eventually has to do some kind of deal with Georgia, which obviously, you know, the links to North Ossetia will remain strong and open. But if you look at the map, South Ossetia really is a kind of huge chunk in the middle of Georgia.
Is there anyone else who wants to ask a question? Otherwise, please. I'll come back to you.
Hi, I'm Sarah Rodine in the Public Health Program here at OSI, and my question is about domestic governments and institutions. And I was curious what you thought, what, if any, impact domestic governments can have on sort of establishing this balance between liberty and stability in the region, and if sort of these other things come about, the establishment of a hub of free trade, the sort of a truce of great powers and the empowerment of local actors like promising businessmen and such, what impact that will have on the development of domestic institutions in the region?
Clearly, it's a huge issue, and the kind of failed democratization of this region is a big issue which I didn't really tackle in this presentation. In a sense, in part because, as it were, these new countries were born in conflict and that kind of rather authoritarian style of leadership, therefore, was reinforced by conflict and the leaders instrumentalized the conflict in order to sort of, say to their oppositions, well, you complain about jobs and you complain about elections, but we're a country at war, we're a country with refugees, and don't forget that, and use that line. So, clearly, this is a big issue, but again, if I go back to my theme that, this is a region where actually the locals set the rules of the game, and the outsiders can't push people around, even if they wanted to, or if they do try and push them around, they have unintended consequences, then I think it's easier to see an economic transformation than a political transformation here, that you can try and help to catalyze economic dynamism in the region and hope that that in turn will have positive political effects. I don't see that you can, there's much you can do, much as you would like to get better governance, freer elections and so on. In Georgia a bit, Georgia they do mind, but even in Georgia they're still pushed back quite strongly against the European Union. They're not, and Georgia's the most pro-European of the three countries, so really there has to be a greater will to embrace these ideas than there is at the moment. Compare it to the Balkans, which is obviously the Balkans and the Caucasus form an interesting point of comparison. There, I think the Balkans, the key difference really is that the Balkans are kind of convinced of a European destiny, and therefore that there are incentives about Europeanization that you can use there, and they see distantly in the end of the tunnel some kind of EU perspective, and you don't have that in the Caucasus. So therefore, what is the incentive to govern yourself better? What is the incentive to be more democratic if you're a leader and you know, lose control and lose economic control as well? So I think, which is why we have to come, if we want to intervene in these countries, we have to come a bit more sideways and look at help facilitating resolution of the conflicts through a kind of promising some kind of security arrangement and kind of trying to catalyze some kind of economic transformation.
Anyone else here who hasn't had a chance before I turn over the floor? Okay, cheers. Okay, so let him go first because he hasn't had a chance, and then I'll come to you, I promise.
All right. My name is Alexis Ward, and I co-edit an online blog called Maritime Security Review. I'm particularly curious about something you mentioned in passing, that Azerbaijan is rearming. I'm just curious about who's benefiting from that. Where they're buying their weapons.
Oh, where are they buying the weapons? All sorts of places. Pakistan, Ukraine, Russia. Recently, they're buying S-300s from Russia, even as Russia signs a military agreement with Armenia. I guess in that case, it may be a case of Russia managing to find a buyer for the S-300s it's decided not to sell to Iran. This is, and Azerbaijan has had the ambition, stated ambition, to spend as much on its military as Armenia spends on its entire state budget. Sounds a bit childish, but that they have said that. So it's about $2 billion a year. The Armenian state budget is about $2.5 billion, so they haven't quite matched it. But certainly a huge amount of money in a small country, which is, you know, could be much better spent on many other things.
And do you know anything about the role of the diaspora from all these countries in this rearming? Specifically, Armenians and Azerbaijanis.
Well, there's no role for the diaspora in the rearming. I mean, the Armenian diaspora in California and France and other places is not in the business of selling weapons. It's very much a matter of political and ideological support.
Thanks. Thank you again. I'm Dr. Polner. I'm president of Cinema Verite, and most of my documentaries on the former Soviet Union are now owned by the Ivy League colleges. I'd like to restate the second part of my first question, which was that Obama seems to be very busy in many other areas of the world and does not appear to be that concerned about Georgia. when Russia took over South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the Russians could have interpreted that very well, that they have this power and they can get away with it. And it seems to me that when the Russians feel that much empowered, they move ahead rather than backwards. So if I was Medvedev or Putin right now, I would be speculating or looking around to see what step I can make without any kind of interference from the Western world. Thank you very much. It's been a very enlightening speech.
But I'm not quite clear how you think they would want to move ahead.
Well, they've already moved into South Ossetia and Abkhazia.
And then what?
I don't know.
Let's get her recorded in that.
Right.
The Russians have already moved into South Ossetia and Abkhazia.
Right.
They did not have much problems with that from their vantage point. They are known for using power, and I don't know what it is. That's why I'm asking you, if they can move ahead there, well, what stops them from moving ahead someplace else and being even more aggressive?
Yeah.
It seems that it's wide open because Obama is not really that, appears not to be that involved in that part of the world. Thank you.
Well, I mean, there were some rumblings in August of 2009 that the, you know, rumblings on the border, Russians making some threats, and a few, you know, phone calls were made between the White House and the Kremlin, and it stopped. And you talk to Georgians, and they say that they actually feel more secure now. The reset has made them feel more secure because better relations between Russia and the U.S. Mean that the likelihood of Russia doing anything more has fallen. So I think I see it the other way around, that the U.S. Russian relationship has made things better. U.S. Russian relationship has made things stable. I mean, President Saakashvili has said that. I think Russians have pretty much bitten off as much as they can swallow in with Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And as I've been trying to make the case, they've stored up a lot of problems for them. So I see absolutely no reason why they would want to risk any more international wrath, cause more problems by going any further. I think they have pretty much what they want now.
I'm going to have to ask you to desist if you don't mind. Are there any more questions from anyone who hasn't had a chance? Okay, as Tom Brokaw used to say, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you all for coming. Please join me in thanking Tom.